Hill, that you really want to be here to do this joint work together. I just want to respect the elder man back here that gave us his presentation. I just want to acknowledge the elder gentleman who shared his presentation with us. I can tell he has a big knowledge and a big heart, and it's a beautiful thing to see. So thank you. It's also interesting for me to see that, as I mentioned to him, we're ending up going towards the same direction in the future from two different experiences. I'm a cultural anthropologist, born and raised in New York City, so I like the re-dramatization of what it used to look like, because I've heard about that a lot myself. My father immigrated to New York a long time ago before he passed away from Yucatan, so that's where my ancestry comes from. And having done a lot of field work in Yucatan and establishing relationships with lots of communities, I learned a lot. I want to share with you a Maya view of the world, a Maya view of history. And part of that is having been able to translate certain colonial documents in Maya. I'll show you some pictures of it, and then Jason can help me with the translation. I'll read the Maya, and then he'll read the English. And what really hit me as a father, when I was translating these documents that I didn't expect, because they have been translated, and they have been published, and I didn't expect to find that they had been translated so inaccurately. And I realized that certain key words, and the scholars that both had passed away, that translated these Chilam Balam documents, were just outstanding scholars, and I actually had the pleasure of meeting one and talking to one and having evaluated my dissertation before I even submitted it. And I really respect them, I really cared about them as people. But because they weren't Maya speakers, they missed certain key words. And by missing those key words, they didn't understand some of the flow of where the direction was going. Because when you work with Maya elders, and they sit you down and tell you something for 6 hours, and you're not only, you know, Maya as an indigenous language is a very interactive language. When somebody's speaking, you don't just sit there and listen. You have to know the syntax and the grammar well enough to know how somebody started their sentences, in what tense, and then where to time your response to show agreement and encouragement for them to continue. And when you work with elders this way, you realize that they're starting with an idea, and then 6 hours later, they've taken you through this path to see if you have enough endurance to hang in there and listen and learn, and then they get to the punchline. But you have to perceive the flow and the logic of that whole thing if you're going to get the punchline. And this is how they test you to see if you're ready to listen to certain things. And I found that this particular document that I want to share with you is structured the same way. And I didn't expect to find out, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks, that it's a prayer in historical context for the souls of Maya girls who were abducted and raped to death for years so that their souls could gain their place in the Milky Way, because even Mayas today that follow the traditional culture consider the human soul after death to need to gain access to the sky and become a new star in the Milky Way. And that's referenced in the prayer, and it's a way to help the girls' souls get to their proper place, both in spite of what happened to them and because of what happened to them, to let them know that they're clean and that none of what happened to them was their fault. So it's just like that. It really feels to me like when you're a parent and your child falls and skins her or his knee, and you try to reassure them and you patch them up. That's kind of what this prayer feels like. So let's build towards that. And let me start off listing for you the five goals that I have for today. So the five main goals in revealing Maya reality. And I think it's important to reveal Maya reality because Maya are very well-known people and very visible, and a lot of imagery, but most of that is not presented by Maya people themselves. It does not benefit Maya people. It benefits governments, it benefits the tourist industry, it benefits entrepreneurs, it benefits academics who exploit that for their own careers. So I'm kind of strange as an academic in that I'm really not participating in that. First goal is to show that the Maya of Yucatan, Mexico, continue a traditional indigenous lifestyle. They're not a past people, they're not a disappeared people, they're still living people. Second goal is that despite having suffered through almost 500 years of colonial domination, so I need to briefly review that domination and how people responded to it. Third, go over these Maya colonial documents, which provide us with a rare indigenous view of how colonialism began. Dr. Spiegelman, we can put together an ethnohistoric reconstruction that is more probably an accurate account of what happened instead of the official colonial history. But we rarely have that ethnohistory coming directly from indigenous documents. And so this is a rare opportunity to see, in Maya terms, how they describe what happened with the first arrival of the Tzul, the foreigners. Today's Maya still learn from their elders how to distinguish their culture from the colonial value system that continues to be promoted. So when you work with people in traditional communities, you work with elders, you're always talking about this, you're always evaluating. It's especially painful to see an elder Maya man who's an official in the Maya system that continues to resist being dominated by the Mexican political system, and see that his six sons have abandoned him, and you end up seeing this sharp generational break between a monolingual indigenous Maya descendant of the original Maya leaders that survived the attempt to eradicate them because some went into hiding and continued certain traditions, and then their own sons have become so westernized, so colonized in their minds that they view their own father as ridiculous. And it's very painful to actually see that happening. So the point is that indigenous people can still resist colonial domination, and I have some ideas about how to do that. I'd like to first acknowledge people that we've lost. Some of you may have known or heard of Ingrid Washina-Watuk, Menominee. She was the executive director of the Fund of the Four Directions in New York City. She financed projects for us for 7 years. She came down to meet with our people and see some of what we were doing. And as you may know, right after she was with us, she went to Colombia to try to help the Uwai indigenous people. And she and two companions were grabbed up by the FARC rebels and assassinated. So we lost a major elder sister. We've also lost recently the two elder Maya gentlemen in the whole Maya system, Don Isidro Camacituc and Comandante Marcelino Potek, as well as the general's wife, Doña Susana. So I always like to start my presentations in honor of them. So who are the Maya, each Maya, according to a Maya way of thinking? There's still about 1 million Maya speakers in the three Mexican states of Campeche, Yucatan, and Quintana Roo. The majority still practice a family, community-based agricultural lifestyle. The penetration that one would have to engage in through the cultural barrier between the world of the Maya and the Tzul, the non-Maya speaker, requires the ability to speak Maya and conform to Maya behavioral norms. I just had a long discussion with my students yesterday about how we can define culture, how we can define language, and when you speak in indigenous language and learned that the speaking of it involves much more than just the words and the grammar. It involves your behavior, it involves your eye contact, your body posture, your endurance, your interaction with the speaker, how you listen as an indigenous person. It's more than culture and language overlap and can really be thought of as the same thing. What's important is that from a Maya point of view, anybody can become a Mayero. Anybody can become a Maya person by learning the language and the behavior that goes along with it. So you don't have the race concept or what people look like being an important factor at all. In fact, there are blonde-haired, blue-eyed Mayas descended from Spanish ancestors who were monolingual Maya speakers in certain communities that I've met, and you know, they're just as Maya as anybody else. So anybody can become a Maya person. Let's talk about that which is Maya in the Maya language. To talk about some key elements of Maya culture, we have to focus on key symbols in the culture. The speaking of Maya language is what being Maya is all about. It's also important to think of what is sacred and what isn't. Anything that's life-giving is sacred, and anything that isn't, isn't. And it just encompasses you in a frame of reference where you're constantly thinking about this and how you talk. The family is sacred. Laughter is a sacred way of sharing all kinds of things and elements, and it's a basic way that people build their relationships. Maya rule of thumb is that everybody makes little jokes about everybody else. So if somebody makes a joke about you, you're not supposed to react defensively. You're supposed to make the joke funnier at your own expense. You're supposed to make everybody laugh more than the original laughter. And then, that just, it usually culminates with you laughing so hard, like you were losing your voice at the end of the talk, that's the way it goes. You're losing your voice because you're laughing so hard, and your head feels like it's ready to split open, and then somebody says, okay, enough, enough. There's a very strong work ethic. You're dealing with mostly still self-sufficient food producers, people that don't buy food but still produce their own food. So if you don't work in a coordinated way according to natural cycles, you're not going to eat. The community and the family are the same thing. I can go to any Maya village, speak in a certain way, use certain words, and instantly establish a family relationship with somebody in 5 seconds. And that's just the way it is. So all of this kind of overlaps. You know, in anthropology, we tend to produce these trait lists, but these are not different parts of culture. The Sakbe is one way that the Milky Way gets referred to. And everybody is born, according to this culture, with a correct road into the future in front of them. So parents are supposed to help children find that road, and we're always talking about that kind of thing. Muchka is a very common saying, the joining of hands for collective work. This is how people show each other that they care about each other. They anticipate what each other needs, and they put their hands to doing something for somebody else without necessarily being asked. And then there's legitimate Maya leadership that continues in spite of the fact that political systems imposed by colonialism try to still dominate those. Let's talk a little bit about the Maya language, Maya Tan. Speaking Maya is the essence of the culture. I can't emphasize enough how your brain gets reordered. I tell my students that even though I teach in English, I feel like everything I say now comes originally from a Maya linguistic frame of reference. In terms of the emphasis on respecting the people that you're talking to, and despite the pressures to finish according to academic time, trying to not hurry certain points. Maya is supposed to be spoken artistically, and the most well-known people in the community are those that are most talented at that kind of thing. Jokes and stories and expressing subtle messages and respect. A lot of times when you speak to elders, they are observing you and testing you and wanting to see as a younger person who they can tell something after they tell you something first. And it just feels like an honor to be invited into that realm of knowledge. It's a very supportive language because there's no word for yes. So you show agreement by repeating something that somebody just said in a certain way to say yes. There are special categories of language. Kit'an is delicious language. That's for speaking to elders. Patbent'an is words left to us. This is words that elders share with young people. So if you show Kit'an as a younger person, you become eligible to receive Patbent'an, counsel and advice. And then Payachi is prayer, and men and women have different realms and ways of praying that are specific to gender. Hahat'an is one way of Maya's talking about the Maya language. It means true language. So there's this tremendous pressure on you in Maya, either linguistically in the way you're speaking or how it codes your brain to tell the truth. Pretty much the worst thing a Maya person can do is lie. And maybe tied with that for the worst thing is exploit or abuse anybody. So it's this very high standard that the language sets for you for what your behavior day to day is supposed to be like. And a lot of people might think that I'm romanticizing the culture too much or glorifying the culture, but when you speak with enough different people in enough different communities, you get that these rules are constantly in play. And the ability of people on a day-to-day basis to still speak in this very stylized, respectful way identifies for people in a continually colonializing world who's who, regardless of what you look like, based on how you speak with other people. Tus, lies, is considered to be spoken by Tsurov outsiders. So Tsurov, or the original Europeans that arrived, are referred to in the documents as Tsurov, foreigners. But that's still a term that's used for any non-Maya speaker, tends to be a Spanish speaker, might be English speaking or from other parts of the world, tourists. So the Maya experience has been to expect lies to come in from the outside, and that's the pattern that people have seen. All of this provides a map for symbolic connections in all parts of the culture and everything that people do. So Maya reality today is that there's a constant contrast between Maya life and the world of the Tzul outsider. There's all kinds of different communities. There's thousands of communities. Some are very far off the road. Some are kind of integrated now into major cities. So you have major populations in major cities like Cancun or Mérida or Campeche. People who assimilate to the Spanish-speaking culture very quickly, very willingly. For example, if you open the phone book, you're going to find a listing for people with the last name Estrella, star. Now, that's not an original Spanish last name from Spain. What it is a translation of the Maya last name, Ek, for star, and at some point in either recent or distant colonial history, people changed their name to the Spanish form of the word to try to assimilate more to Spanish-speaking culture and get certain potential for upward social mobility that you're not going to have otherwise. Even though Mayas are poor, there is a cultural motivation for Maya speakers to see each other as morally cleaner, richer, and closer to Haja Dios, which is the Maya translation for the true God. This results in a hidden Maya world that is only accessible by speaking Maya and living and traveling between Maya communities. So people can go on vacation down there, they can go to the archaeological sites, they can talk to academics, they can talk to a lot of bilingual Maya and Spanish people, and they can think that they're having a cultural experience, and maybe they are. But the reality is, if you can't speak Maya and go into these communities in a Maya way, you are not fully accessing Maya reality in any kind of a complete way. It is then possible to perceive that Mayas think of ourselves as one big ka, one big community, or one big chiban family. But this community constantly has four corners, penetrated by kas, penetrated by evil, which motivates constant prayers and offering among traditional Mayas. And this even relates to the Maya concept of sickness. You still have some communities, well, all communities that I've ever been to, and I always ask the question, conceive of themselves as having four corners, and people can show you where they are. And the four corners usually have four roads coming in from different directions. And those roads penetrate the surface of the four corners of the community, so they become dangerous access points for evil winds, which bring sickness. So it's important to do ceremonies and walk counterclockwise and then clockwise so that you kind of untie, you invite the four guardian grandfathers from the core four corners of the earth. People still do this stuff, from the four corners of the earth to the four corners of the community, or the four corners of your cattle corral, or your four-cornered cornfield, or your four-cornered house, or the four-cornered human body, to ask for protection or curing an illness. And then the motion is to go back clockwise and tie it back up again. So you participate in enough different kinds of ceremonies like this. The tzul outsider is symbolically equated with the kas evil, kas ik wind that brings sickness. Here's an example of muchkav, the joining of hands for collective work, and this is considered correct work. It's the height of Maya cultural behavior to do things for no pay, help other people. This was with Ingrid's help, with the funding that she provided, we built that structure to hold meetings on some land that we were able to buy. And that was all put up by people's collective work. I was invited once to give a talk in 1995 in Chetumal by the International Congress of Mayanists, all these Maya academic specialists from all over the world. And I said, you know what, I appreciate the invitation, but have you ever had Maya legitimate leaders speak at any one of your conferences? And no. You could do that? That's what I have to ask them and find out. And they said that they would do it, so they organized this contingent, and I was kind of the tour guide and the translator. And it was just this fascinating experience to see all these worldwide experts on the Maya separated by this kind of Grand Canyon distance, symbolically and literally, between these representatives of the continuing Maya system of respect, community obligations, and there was no middle ground. There was no, I knew a lot of people in the audience, and only two came up to say hi to me, and the rest were just giving me dirty looks, like if I violated their academic space. And it was just quite a thing to see, that the world experts on Maya culture weren't comfortable in the presence of such leaders. So let's start to locate spatially where the Maya are. America Latina is all of this, including the Caribbean. And we're talking, of course, about the Yucatan Peninsula up there. Here's Izamal, where my father and our family is originally from. The third largest pyramid in the Americas is still there. So all of this is Maya territory in terms of the continued speaking of the language. So let's start to deal with the colonial story. Quisqueya is the original Taino indigenous name for what's now Haiti and the Dominican Republic. So that became Colón or Columbus's headquarters. And massive depopulation. A very famous study in 1971 by Cook and Bora estimated that there were 8 million indigenous people there originally, and they were about 99% depopulated in 30 years. Very large populations on all these islands, Puerto Rico, Jamaica, Cuba. So Bartolomé de las Casas wrote a very famous book, Brevísima Relación de la Destrucción de las Indias, a short account of the destruction of the Indies of these islands and into Yucatán. And Las Casas and many others teach us, in their own words, sometimes people like him that were positioning themselves on the side of indigenous people, some of the first advocates of indigenous rights, others like Bishop Landa, who were engaging in inquisitions and tortures to find out what people were doing, secret ceremonies, and became, ironically, somebody who burned Maya libraries. We only have 4 Maya books left, but certain descriptions of what he was writing for his Spanish administrators give us descriptions of Maya life that we wouldn't have otherwise. So some excerpts and excerpts from Las Casas translated into English. This would be on this island where now Haiti and the Dominican Republic are. The president did not give the great quantity of gold asked for. They burned him and a number of other nobles and caciques with the intention of leaving no prince or chieftain alive in the entire country. The Spaniards took babies from the mother's breasts, grabbing them by the feet and smashing their heads against rocks. They built a long gibbet, low enough for the toes to touch the ground and prevent strangling, and hanged 13 natives at a time. Then straw was wrapped around their torn bodies and they were burned alive. So what the Spanish came up with, that anthropologist Michael Taussig calls the culture of terror, as the way to engage in this severe brutality for the purpose of psychological warfare, to express through violence that a very small number of guys intended to take over this territory with all these millions of people gets perfected in the Caribbean and then spreads to the Latin American mainland as the typical way of introducing yourself to the native population. And the requerimiento that Dr. Spiegelman referenced became law. You had to read this thing. But it was obviously as much to motivate your soldiers to go in with a clean conscience and do this stuff because you blamed the victim ahead of time for what was going to happen. This particular scene is from Yucatan itself. As the Spaniards went with their war dogs, and these big mastiff war dogs, 200, 300 pound dogs. They didn't have Gaines burgers in those days, so we know what they ate, right? As the Spaniards went with their war dogs hunting down Indian men and women, it happened that a sick Indian woman who could not escape from the dogs sought to avoid being torn apart by men. In this fashion, she took a cord and tied her year-old child to her leg, and then she hanged herself from a beam, but the dogs came and tore the child apart before the creature expired, however a friar baptized it. From Bishop Landa, we're told of another woman who is referenced by Tsveten Torodov, who recently wrote a book that he dedicated to this Maya woman torn apart by dogs, because she was the Nohoches, the elder's wife, and she promised him before he went out of town to meet the Spaniards and try to protect the community, that if something happened to him, she would never take another husband. She would never be with another man. She was promising him this. He was killed. So the Spanish captain, the Spanish very often would try to engage in public rapes of prominent women to show everybody who is in charge now. And sometimes they are documented to tie up the husband and throw him somehow under the woman, maybe rape her in a hammock above him or something as an act of domination. So this Spanish captain is trying to rape this Nohoche's wife in front of the community that's been brought to the center of the town, all the survivors. And she's fighting him off and fighting him off and saying to her people, okay, you see me fighting him off? if I don't make it, that's what you have to do. And so he couldn't have his way with her, and he got fed up and threw her, if he couldn't rape her, he was gonna let her, his dogs eat her in front of everybody. So Tsveten Todorov dedicated his book to a Maya woman devoured by dogs. Now it goes along with the atrocities perpetrated among indigenous people and the Americans is the atrocities perpetrated in Africa. And when I first found this map, it kind of blew up a part of my head that's never going to come back, okay? Because I'm going to show you a map later of the recent genetic routes of migration out of Africa that have been reconstructed from analyzing mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome analysis. Ironically, if it in fact is true, as the data seems to indicate, that humanity migrates from an original African birthplace to the rest of the planet, then both European and Arab humans return to Africa for the purpose of extracting our cousins in an enslaved condition and transporting them to much of the rest of the world. So the brown arrows are where the Arab slave extraction routes, and the green arrows are the European extraction routes, with the west coast of Africa blown up here, showing these Portuguese and British and other European forts that were built here for establishing holding cells. So the five causes of African death in the process of eventually creating African-American people in this country and elsewhere consists of, one study estimates 36 to 60 million Africans die in the course of hundreds of years of trying to extract Africans to send them elsewhere in enslaved condition. So the first cause of death, who knows how many millions, resisting capture. Second cause of death, dying in the holding cells. Third cause of death, dying in the middle passage. One study of the Atlantic Ocean by marine biologists shows that so many human bodies were thrown in the Atlantic Ocean that it permanently has changed the type of bacteria growing in the Atlantic Ocean. Fourth cause of death, the seasoning process. The survivors taken off the slave ships are subjected to all kinds of brutalities, sleep deprivation, food deprivation, beatings, rapes, to psychologically break them down and again communicate through the culture of terror and violence that you will do what we want you to do. What we want you to do as slave masters is to accept that you are our slave, you will never escape this, and your only chance to have any kind of family is to teach your children to accept a future lifetime of slavery. Kind of a reverse seven generation. And then the fifth cause of death is being worked to death. So this institution of enslavement of people cannot be somehow separated from the colonial experience, colonial reality, the creation of wealth. You're going to make, as Dr. Spiegelman showed, a lot of money capturing indigenous territory, not paying anything for it, mapping it, and then being able to sell it to somebody else even though you didn't pay anything for it. Same thing with how much wealth you're going to create for yourself and your descendants if you have millions of people doing all kinds of labor for you and you never have to pay them for it. So the same indigenous Africans and indigenous Americans share the enslavement experience in Latin America and up into Yucatan because Africans are brought in where the depopulation of the indigenous population was so severe from a colonial slave-owning mentality, you had to repopulate your slave population this way. And it also becomes big business. I mean, it's a huge money-making thing. There's a group of African-American lawyers continuing to pursue legal action against 100 top American corporations, documenting that they all evolved out of the slave trade and should therefore be pressured to engage in some kind of reparations to the descendants of the enslaved. The first official Spanish trip to Yucatan is Francisco Hernández de Córdoba, 1517, landing here right up at the tip where there was a big Maya community, obviously a major part of their own trade system. There was a lot of salt, and still is a lot of salt, produced in the lagoons right at the northern edge of Yucatan. So salt is always an important thing, right? So where are the Maya? Yucatan? There's a kind of weird little story about where the word Yucatan comes from. So this tip was called by the Spanish Cabo Catoche, Cape Catoche. Why did they call it that? Because when they landed there, the Maya said to them, Nesh Catoche, which means, let's go to our home. So Catoche, Catoche, that's what they heard. They thought that was the name of the place. And they were probably asking in their Castilian Spanish, ¿Cómo se llama este lugar? What's the name of this place? And the Maya said to them, Yucatan, which means your words are shaken up. I can't understand you. So that's my own reconstruction of where the word Yucatan comes from. It sounds like a very exotic Maya name or something, but it's a classic case of colonial linguistic problems. So what's the colonial reality for indigenous people, including the Maya? The process starts with an incredible indigenous death rate. Demographers have studied this very responsibly, so we have a lot of population reconstructions. On average, around the world, 90% of the indigenous population dies depopulated within 50 years after contact with Europeans. So we're talking about, in some cases, of course, extermination of entire indigenous peoples within 50 years. Five causes of indigenous death. Massacres and genocide. Who knows how many millions that way. Then you have the disruption of the food production system. So you've got starvation being another problem. If you're enslaved, you're worked to death. You also have new diseases being introduced, but the new diseases are being introduced into a diminished immune system because of the starvation. And then you have another class of diseases like cholera and amoebic dysentery that come from having to live under much dirtier conditions now and having a problem getting clean water. And then we have death by cultural trauma. Some people just give up and die. Some people commit suicide. Whole communities commit mass suicide. The individual cultural trauma thing was driven home for me by a friend, indigenous woman activist from Guatemala, who told me that she's afraid her sister's just going to die one day. And this is now, because she's been raped so many times by Guatemalan soldiers that she can't speak anymore. She's losing her humanity. She either cries or laughs. Anthropologist John Bodley estimates at least 50 million indigenous dead worldwide just between 1780 and 1930, which is easier to document than earlier in the colonial period. But the death toll before 17 early, so let's say 1492 to 1780, what, 300 years, must have been higher than this figure. This is motivated by the culture of consumption, which is, of course, the lifestyle that we are still obliged to be involved in, using the culture of terror. So the standard dominant Western way of expressing colonial domination is that a supposedly superior people took off for a supposedly weaker people. But again, as Bodley points out very accurately, we can't discount the strategic use of the culture of terror in establishing this new domination. And that typically gets left out of the Western accounts of colonial history. So, I teach a course on prejudice and discrimination, and one easy to remember definition for discrimination that I teach my students is that you could call it getting ahead at other people's expense, which is Western lifestyle par excellence, right? I mean, this is what we're all supposed to be doing if we're conforming to the dominant culture. In school, whatever, we're supposed to be getting it. A lot of people don't think of that as discrimination, but you technically can define it as such. So getting ahead at other people's expense has been more massive than we've been taught. the Maya experience with colonialism. Indigenous leaders, come on. Indigenous leaders and any who resist are killed. And let me back up. And the documents that I'm going to show you and translate for you, we'll never know for sure, but it's really kind of amazing that the Spanish conquest, quote unquote, of Yucatan is supposedly complete by about 1545. And these documents were probably written in 1560, only 15 years later, in the Maya language, using European script, using Spanish alphabet, probably because there was severe anxiety about the books and libraries being burned, and a desire to get some of this catalog written down before people forgot it. So it was probably the case that the sons of killed leaders who were put in Catholic school by the friars and taught Spanish and Latin strategically used the education to decide themselves, how do we write Maya in this new alphabet, and work with the elders to write down their oral history, because that's all we're going to have left. So being able to translate this document for people allows me to bring a voice from the 1500s to the present for all that want to listen to it, because it was intended specifically for that purpose, so that this history wouldn't be lost. After the violence, you have the enslavement. Enslavement in Maya is called palitzil, which means, and elders and elder men and women talking to younger people still talk about this and still converse this and still consider Maya life today to still be in a version of palitzil, because especially for Maya men who travel outside of Maya communities more than women to do business, however little, it's a very difficult thing as a full-grown man, respected elder in your community, to then go into a Spanish-speaking environment and be treated like a boy. And so this being made into a child is something that Mayas still experience in their dealings with Spanish-speaking Mexican or Yucateco society. This enslavement is called encomienda in Spanish, which is kind of an interesting word, because if you know any Spanish, this means entrustment. So the encomendero, the slave master, is being entrusted by the Spanish crown to Christianize his Indians and send some of his profit back to the Spanish crown in tax, and then he can essentially do whatever he wants. So encomienda means being awarded an area of territory, very much as Dr. Spiegelman described in dividing up New York State, and in this case, the surviving indigenous people on it as your slaves to do with whatever you want. So this has begun in the Caribbean islands and then spreads to the rest of Latin America as the institution of enslavement of indigenous people into which Africans are brought in different places at different times. Area of the Chocó in Colombia was discovered to have a lot of gold and emeralds right in the soil. So for 300 years, the Spanish set up an enslavement encomienda system where Africans were brought in, because the ones that survived all of that series of possible deaths getting there were very tough. And so they made good miners. So for 300 years, they and their families were miners of gold and emeralds, and the indigenous people were enslaved for 300 years just to grow food to feed the African miners and the slave masters. So what would that be like? You know, the kind of anthropology I practice and try to teach about always involves how willing are you to put yourself in other people's position. That's why I was kind of having a near-death experience here listening to Dr. Spiegelman's talk, because I couldn't help putting myself in the position of all these people that you were talking about as a father, thinking about how would I try to keep my kids alive under these conditions. That's my way of learning, you know? So what would it be like to be part of a family, enslaved for 300 years, mining or feeding the miners, and that's all you do, and that's all you're ever gonna be able to do, and if you don't like it, you're dead, and you're probably dead anyway. So it's impossible to calculate how much of today's wealth comes from centuries of not having to pay enslaved workers. I knew of a family when I was doing my first field work in Hacienda, in a very retired place, no roads, no nothing. Supposedly a family of 11 people was still, I guess you couldn't call it slavery because they were being paid, but they were still effectively enslaved on this hacienda. And collectively, these 13 people were making $11 a month. And that's their life, to stay there and do whatever the landowner wants. During the colonial period, on top of the working for somebody for free, a tribute tax is instituted. So documents will be produced by the Spaniards for how much, how many thousand turkeys a region is supposed to provide for the encomendero, or bolts of cotton cloth. Mayas don't cultivate cotton anymore, but they used to be experts in that. Or bags of corn, or vats of honey. Mayas are still very good beekeepers. There's a beautiful stingless bee down there that's being killed by other bees introduced that do sting. It's kind of going extinct. I know people that are trying to keep it alive. But a very beautiful, pure honey that's used as medicine, it's used as eye drops. How much honey do you have to provide? How many wax candles do you have to provide? So thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of people's labor is not only being used for what the slave master wants, but on top of that, you have to pay this tribute tax, because there was no gold. So when Europeans go around the world and don't find gold and silver, they look for substitutes. So this is the Maya gold, what Mayas in their agriculture learned over thousands of years, learned to produce in Yucatan. This is still seen today in marketplaces where Mayas tried to sell their produce. This has been documented around the world as a very smart colonial technique for maintaining people in an impoverished condition. That you, whatever the market price is for whatever you're trying to sell, you're paid below the market price when you sell, and you're forced to pay above the market price when you buy. So if you're, I'll show you a picture later, if you're a Maya farmer and you have your 200-pound bag of corn and you're carrying it, maybe you got a little bit of a lift from somebody's truck or something, to the marketplace, if you're supposed to get 500 pesos, you're a Maya guy, you're going to get 300 pesos. You don't like it, drag it someplace else. So this is one of the main mechanisms for how people are maintaining a condition of extreme poverty. So Mexico, let me just back up. Mexico in general is suffering from this. It's become a net importer of corn, okay? The earliest archaeological evidence for where human beings turn wild Zia maize into corn like we have today, and you can see archaeologically, I had a graduate class by the archaeologist who discovered in the Tehuacan Valley this dry cave where you can see the corn cobs getting bigger as you get closer to the present. So if this place indicates that Mexico was first domesticated, a place where corn was first domesticated, now Mexico is a net importer of corn because the countryside is still this colonial robbery going on, and people give up on agriculture and come to places like this looking for another economic alternative. There's the systematic rape during the colonial period and into the present by soldiers, slave masters, and even Catholic priests. And this is going on for centuries. And this Maya uprising that I'm going to tell you about was, according to the story told by elders still today, about 150 years later, inspired by one Maya elder who, his little girl was abducted, and when he found her in a cave with these Maya women who were all in various stages of pregnancy, telling him that the priests have this prostitution ring where they would get these Maya girls and women pregnant and then tell them, you can't go back to your family because you'll be disgraced, and they would literally sell them into prostitution. And this Maya elder just got fed up with that and went crazy and started this uprising that might be the most famous indigenous uprising in the Americas that I'll tell you about in a minute. So the whole story is told by Myers in the Chilam Balam documents that asked for Jason's help during the second in the mid-1500s. So another part of my brain blew up when I found out that Princeton University has scanned these things and has them online, and it doesn't cost anything to get them. And so I can show you the actual pages of the document that's been transcribed and translated from the Chilam Balam of Chumayam. So how many pages do we have here? I mean, it gives me chills that I can actually understand what this says. So let's bring up that Word document, and then Jason's going to help me here. So this is going to tell about first European arrival, what happens to these girls, and I think we'll get the point. Can you maybe blow that up to 150?
What year is that, please?
Huh?
What year is it?
Well, it's a little bit not precisely known, but probably 1560, 1565. But then what happens is it gets added to. So, and it gets passed down, and I know villages that still have secret Chilam Balam documents, and one guy was telling me that some blonde guy in a jeep came barreling into his hometown, ran to the church, knew where to hit the wall with a sledgehammer, got a hidden Chilam Balam out of there, and barreled out of town, and nobody ever saw it again. Nobody even knew it was in there. So nobody knows who he was, how he knew that. But there's an international market for selling these things if you can find one. And so I tend not to want to say where. Okay. So just a note to myself. This nohoch, this sounds to me like a dictated story that some diligent young person or young people, set of young people wrote down. And this elder has a very deliberate narrative style using many details, which allows the story to be patiently and fully and patiently told. So just so you can hear the Maya language, probably close to how it was originally intended, I'll recite the Maya lines and then Jason's going to read the translations for you. And don't worry about, you know, any pronunciation, just give it your best shot, we'll be fine.
The remembrance of the khatuns in the years?
So the khatun is a 20-year cycle, and it was very important. If you had a network of communities that had a relationship, they would rotate the 20-year honor of being in charge of all the ceremonies and festivals associated with the khatun. And sometimes they would fight about whose turn it was. No, it's not your turn, it's my turn. So this was a very basic part of the relationship between communities. Uyash chukil upeteler yukatan to menet stolov sakwinko.
The capturing, rape, and conquest of the land of the Yucatan by the foreigners, the white men.
Ichibuluk ahukatun uchik.
In 11 ahukatun this happened.
So these things were counted, and so academics have correlated what European years that's equivalent to. So we're talking somewhere early 1500s, let's just leave it like that. Uchukikov uchol ha'eka.
They captured it, the port of Eka.
Tilakin utalelo.
From the east they came.
Ka'ulo op bin uyash kam chitabo.
When they arrived, the anona, or pond apple, was the first thing they accepted and laid down with.
So they were coming, the Spanish were coming into a new area, they didn't know what to eat, they found this wild fruit, and the Mayas described them as lying down with it the way they're about to lie down with our women.
Still, the beginning of their name.
Amak of Tsurilo.
The Anona people, foreigners.
Atsuts of Tsur Ukabo.
The suckers of the Anonas was their name.
Heshbin ukaba u yotochnalo uchu kahyog ekabe.
So that will be their name, given by the residents, they, the conquerors of Ikab.
Na kombala ukaba lehish Yashchuki te ekabe.
Or Captain Balaam was the name of the one who was first conquered there at Ikab.
So for all we know, this was the guy who died, and then his wife maybe was the one eaten by the dogs. Tume yash kapitane Don Juan Montejo.
By the first captain, Don Juan Montejo.
Yash conquistador Waitupe tener Yucatan lae.
The first conquistador here in this land of Yucatan.
Lai ukatunir uchki ukuchun ish kaansiho lae.
It was still the same Katun when he arrived at Ikat An Siho.
So that's the Maya name of Merida, which is the capital city of the state of Yucatan today. Uhabil 1513 años.
In the year 1513.
Oshlahunahau Katun Uchki Uchukiko Kampech.
Katun 13 Ahu is when their conquest happened at Kampech. One count of the Katun had passed them by then. Priest Kamal came out from Kampech.
So this would have been an Ahoch in charge of this other major city, Kampeche, on the western coast of Yucatan today.
Enter foreigners here into this land. It will be
in 20 de agosto.
On the 20th of August.
Tuhabil de 1541.
Of the year 1541.
Tu chikbesab tu ukabahabo.
I am registering the name of the year.
Uhopik Christiano ilai.
In which this Christianity began.
1519 años.
1519.
Kuchikwak alhab ka tatbuluk ishabi uchki concierto yetetsulo.
It arrives at the end of the year, when it is at 11 measurement of years, when an agreement was reached with the foreigners. It is done by you starting to pay with other people at the beginning of the foreigners. Katun, sorry. So here in our communities, they became the captains of those towns long ago. You'll have to pay this tribute, they say. And he, Kamal, says it will be so. Written by me in the year 1541. The first arrival of the foreigners from the east. Ekab is its name.
So this is that major town at the corner of the peninsula. Tuhalbi uchki u kuch ulobi.
The year in which their arrival happened.
Tuhorha Ekab.
At the port of Ekab.
Tukaha Nakombala.
At his town, Nakumbala.
Tuyaschun ku ukini u tuhalbi ukatunit buluk ahau katun.
The first beginning of its days, its years, is Katun 11 Ahu.
Kapasho a Itzal.
When they broke and destroyed the Itzal.
So the Itzal is a Maya name for the ruling dynasty that would give the leaders. Horhun alha Itale.
Heading for a 20-year period that's coming.
So there's a 20-year period, that's when the Spanish arrived, now they're talking about the 20 years after.
The arrival of the foreigners.
Kapashi ka Saklatun.
When the town of Saklatun was depopulated.
So we don't even know exactly where all these places are, but they're named and all talk about, described as being depopulated. Kapashi ka Kinchil Kobat.
When the town of Kinchil Chobo was depopulated.
Kapashi ka tu Chichen Itzam.
When the town at the mouth of the well of Itza was depopulated.
So this is one of the biggest tourist places in the peninsula now, with big pyramid and all that kind of thing. Kapashi Kakusas Ushman.
When the town of Outer Uxmal was depopulated.
Ushmal is also another big tourist place now. Tunohol Ka Ushman.
The great city of Ushmal.
Kiruk Ala Yete Kaba.
Kib it is called Ankaba.
Pash Ka Seye.
Destroyed town Seye.
Yete Pakam.
And Pakam.
Yete Homtum.
And Homtun.
Tikaish Kalom Kin.
There at the town of Kalom Kin.
Yete Ake.
And Ake.
Hotun Ake.
Hotun Ake.
Pashika Emelchak.
The town of Emelchak was destroyed.
Etzimal.
Etzimal.
That's probably my family's hometown. It's now called Isamal. Tieni Uyish Mehen Haku.
There the daughter of the true God came down.
Uyunikan.
The father of the sky.
Ishahal.
The woman ruler.
Ishuhun.
The virgin woman.
And she's being invoked, I think, now to prepare for this testimony of what happened to the girls, because she's the moon. This is what the moon would be called in the sky, and the moon is the caretaker of women, probably because the lunar cycle of 29 days is the same as the 29 days of human female menstruation. Ishuhun.
She, the miraculous one.
When
the ruler said,
Emom Chin,
come down.
Kinich Kakmo.
Kinich Kakmo.
Ma Patik Ti Ahawilwaye.
He didn't remain as the ruler here.
Waiti Pati.
He remained.
That's okay.
He remained the female miraculous one.
Ich Sa Yati.
She who gives mercy.
Emom Sum.
Come down, rope.
Emom Tab Tab.
Come down, cord that comes from the sky. Come down, words that come from the sky.
So when you're doing ceremonies, and you see Maya Shane is doing this today, you're constantly exchanging words with the sky, and you believe, as it's been described to me, that the result of the ceremony is like receiving language. Like Kikun Tavi Uyahalim.
Her rulership here became content. Because of the towns fulfilling their agreement. When she said it to them, the rulership of Emal didn't remain. When the great Itza leaders are going, 13 × 400 = 5,200. The number of their many.
It's possible that this is talking about trying to pull together a massive Maya army to confront these Spanish guys. Ka-tak hor-hum-bak.
When they reach 15 × 400, 6,000.
U-bak-al-u-ho-kahili.
The number of their people.
U-nuk-te-lo e-regreso a-itao.
They were called the Isa heretics.
So they were... The Mayas had invited them in, probably a strategic thing to check out who these guys are and figure out what's going on. Then when we see what these people are like, we have to put an army together to deal with them. Hetun bini uyatsen tu teo.
They will go, the sustainers of the people.
So the sustainers of the people. This is a metaphor for corn farmers being used as warriors now to confront the Spanish. Sham Nun Bilo.
Also their suffering.
Mintu Pacho Tsent Koblei.
Went with them at their backs and they fed them.
Now this jumps to having been defeated, and now the Mayas are having to feed the Spanish. Osh Hun Is Binu Ishimal Upon.
13 measures of corn per head.
So this is the institution of the tribute and how much you have to start paying. Ukwentailo.
Was their required amount.
Katak bolon is amut.
When it was 9 measures paid as tribute.
Katak osh ok u shimbalo.
When it was 3 jobs to carry the corn.
Yash yab ish mehen kaho.
Then many young girls of the towns.
And here comes the part that always tears my heart out of my chest. Binu wai tanilo.
Were taken away in collars before them.
Upachopsha.
And behind them.
Matu yoheltao upak to tsulo.
They didn't know that the foreigners awaited them.
Ma u Christiano ilo.
They were not Christianized.
Ma u yoheltao u bot patan.
These girls didn't know they were being considered payment of tribute.
Hawaiian chicho.
The Hawaii birds.
Hawaiian tuno.
The Hawaii stones.
In Maya villages today, if you go in a lot of houses, you're going to see a little cross on the ceiling, and that's because it's still part of the cosmology of the people, that there are these animal transformers into birds that are very dangerous, and they can fly into your house, and if you have a baby, they can snatch the baby and fly back out. So this is to protect the family and the babies from these birds. So the Spanish are being metaphorically referred to as these stealers of babies. Hawaiian sinin tuno.
The live pulp taught stones.
So this is it's very uncomfortable for Mayas to talk about sexual things, even today. Very, very difficult. So this is a metaphor, I think, to refer to the Spanish as rapists. Hawaiian balamo.
The Y jaguars.
Oshwayaho.
Three Ys.
Kanbakha.
4 years is meat.
Ushuru kushtalo.
It is the end of their lives.
Katakholhun kalhavyan kataki.
Even though it is 300 years, there is still remembrance.
So this document was probably copied and recopied into the 1800s, and that's why this is showing kind of an accordion effect between the past and the present at that time. Kashul tugu kushtalo.
An abrupt, violent end to their lives.
Tumenu yohlo upis inog ubao.
Because they know how to measure their days.
Tulis u.
An entire month.
Tulis ha.
An entire year.
Tulis kin.
An entire day.
Tulis aka.
An entire night.
So all the measurements of time is suffering for these girls. Tulis ik. So here's the wind metaphor describing like an arriving sickness. Kushimbasha.
Walks also.
Tulis kiksha.
Entire blood also.
Tukuchu wayo.
Arrives at their beds.
Tupopo.
Their mats where they sleep.
Now what's interesting to me here is pop is a mat where people sleep, but it's also a reference to the mat that the ruler would sit on. So it's a symbol of leadership. So to me, the girls are being referred to, they're being elevated to the status of leaders of the people. And this is one of those key words that my colleagues missed. You change the accent here, and it means two different things. And I think it's a low-tone accent, and that makes it pregnancy. Tutsamo.
Their pregnancies.
Pis u kushantiko u yuchil orao.
Their lives were measured by their good times.
So their lives shouldn't be defined by being raped. Pis u kushantiko u yuchil kin.
Their lives were measured by their good days. They see their complete measurement as they enter the backbone of the royal stars.
I find this an incredibly beautiful way to describe the Milky Way.
They are putting their eyes into the royal backbone of the stars.
Utstun tulata katun utakbes uyalo.
Everything is good, then when they mix their tears together then.
Tukus olalo.
Their loss of virginity.
Yaminantun keban tu santo ok olalo.
There is then no sin in their sacred faith.
Yan ukushtalo.
There is their lives.
Minantun u chapahan.
There is certainly no filth.
Minantum uchibil baktio.
There is certainly no biting of the bones for them.
And this is starting to describe new illnesses that were brought in by the Spanish that the Mayas are describing this way. So they're dead, so they don't have to go through all these sicknesses that we're getting sick with now. Minantum yanakiloktio.
There is certainly no smallpox for them.
Minantun enel tzemeltio.
There is certainly no getting thin while burning for them.
Minantun yanakiltio.
There is certainly no constant pain for them.
Minantun tzentzem kimiltio.
There is certainly no lingering death for them.
Minantun chibi poltio.
There is certainly no headache for them.
Sono virtuno vino vinculo.
Their bodies have been put in order.
Ma betun umea umentazulo ti urilobe.
Not as the foreigners did to them when they arrived here.
Sahab solil tasao katalo.
Orderly fear was brought to them when they, the foreigners, came.
Kakushi uyonite.
When their sacredness lost its virginity.
Kushitum uyotuniteo.
Lost virginity, then, was the center of their sacred flower.
This is another way of referring to the moon.
Nachit shuchit was the sacredness she shared with the other girls.
Minantun uyutskino yeter sahabotam.
There are no good days for them since they are lost to us.
Lai uchun ka'in shek.
This is how the two-day thrones begin.
So this is referring to the Spanish killing off legitimate Maya leaders and installing Maya stooges in their place to collect their taxes for them. And they're described in this and other documents as these lewd, disgusting guys. Again, the implication is trying to take advantage of whatever women they can that have no legitimacy to be in the position that they're in. Where are we, Jason? Right at the top?
Yeah, right at the top.
Kakin Aharil.
The two-day rulers.
Laishutun kimitonshan.
This is how death began for us, too.
Kashu kasat mil uyi yetesu tali etlahom tulaka.
The end, when loss is seen along with shame for all our other selves.
This is a basic Maya way of referring to other people. This is one of those key words that you can still use today to get this quick family relationship with people. When you say etlak, my other self, and boom, that's it. So this is a way of referring to all Mayas as our other selves. Mina nohoch kan.
There is no great serpent.
So this is the ecliptic in the sky with the head in the east, the head in the west. This is probably the Maya version of the creator of the universe. Mina nu yahal tan.
There are no longer any special words from the rulers. There is no sacred snake there. Another type of ruler arrived there. Dishonest penis, Catholic. Priests come and have caused intestinal pain there. And the foreigners left their children behind here at the walls of town. They, the children, are truly receiving their miserable poverty. This is how it happened with these same foreigners. If they were legitimate Itza rulers, three times pierced by sharp stones would have happened to the foreigners.
So if the fake rulers of today, at this time, were they like the old rulers used to be, they would have taken care of the foreigners, but now they're their stooges.
But it is still 60 years since we have had tribute put upon us. Because their bite happened to us. But there are still Itza people here. We might not do it, but we will pay for it. It will be, if there is agreement, there is a limit to when peace might exist between us and the foreigners. If not, there might be a great war coming between us.
I don't have any idea how long I've gone or how much time has left. I don't know if I should cut it off here or finish it up with a little bit more material I have. What's your pleasure? Are you tired? Do you need a break? Keep going a little bit? Okay. Thank you, Jason.
I'll get you back to where you were.
Japan. So in 1847, this Maya uprising occurred that is called in Maya Ubate Hahagios, the War of the True God. This name was taught to me by the elders of the Maya Zone, who are the descendants of the original generals that led this uprising. Many scholars consider this Maya uprising, which begins in 1847, to be the most successful indigenous revolt in all the Americas. So this would have been of longer duration and more successful than something like King Philip's War. It effectively ends 300 years of Maya enslavement by Spaniards and Criollos. Criollos is people of Spanish descent born in the Americas. It results in an independent Maya territory which lasts until 1901. Many Mayas today in the Maya zone of Quintana Roo say they were never reconquered and still consider themselves to be living in this independent territory. It remains a key symbol of Maya identity still today. The revolt is mostly known by non-Mayas as the caste war, sometimes referred to as the caste war of Yucatan. So in this map, it shows how in the east, this revolt spread, killing and pushing surviving Spanish speakers toward, the western end of the peninsula. The main first phase was 1847 to 1848. And to make a long story short, the U.S. invasion of Mexico in 1846 requires the Mexican army to go north to deal with them. And the elite Spanish-speaking criollo class of Yucatan wants to take advantage of that and become independent from the rest of Mexico and have their own country. So they conscript Mayas into their army because there weren't enough of them to make a big army. And what do you think the Mayas did when they got the guns in their hand and the training? And they said, it's finally time to take care of business. So Mayas sweep western towards Mérida and Campeche. And there are three different stories about why the advance stops. It was either the time for the rains, which means it's time for planting, because if you don't plant, your family's not going to be able to eat for a year. That was probably part of it. There's also indication that some of the generals were split from each other by Spanish-speaking payoffs of some guys. But we'll never really know the exact reason. So what is invisible today about Maya? Maya culture is invisible as it exists to most people. 300 years of enslavement, Palitzil, and its effects are invisible to most non-Mayas. Increasing poverty, malnutrition, infant mortality, exposure to disease, and the demands of the tourist industry are invisible to most non-Mayas. Decreasing access to health care. Decreasing practice of Maya shamanism, midwifery, herbal indigenous medicine, and ceremonialism. Decreasing community solidarity as people leave to move to work up here or go to Cancun or someplace like that. An increase in the generation gap, a loss of respect for elders. It's a very difficult thing, either as a person of Maya ancestry or as an anthropologist, to see somebody that is of the age where their culture and lifetime has prepared them for being an elder, and now I've seen such people in certain circumstances with nobody left to treat them as an elder and give them the role to play that they've been prepared their whole life to play. We have the same lack of access to fair markets as we've had for 500 years. Invisible political domination, paternalism, and loss of self-determination. Causes of the invisibility. Colonial dominance of indigenous people has become the norm. The archaeological and hieroglyphic study of Maya life emphasizes the past and not the present. The Mexican national and state governments have a desire to profit from tourism. And there's just a general Western difficulty in understanding, and that's one reason it's such a pleasure listening to my colleague over here, because he obviously understands this. Understanding non-Western cultures in their own terms, what anthropologists call practicing cultural relativism. Understanding other cultures in their own terms instead of as categorized as Indians or categorized in some other kind of way. So, lots of pictures now to finish up with some questions. Archaeological and hieroglyphic emphasis in Maya studies. La Ruta Maya, this massive international plan to turn the whole peninsula into a set of tourist resorts that will further subjugate the Maya to what can be called neo-colonialism, a new form of colonialism. I even heard of plans, I don't know if they're going to be put into action, to build a monorail so tourists can ride above Maya communities and look down and check it out. If you go on the internet and find El Mundo Maya, the Maya world, it sounds like this exotic thing. People even use words like ecotourism, but it's, to use my colleague's term, a lot of no, I'm on the radio, I can't say. Never mind. You know what I mean. But this is this government-promoted alternate reality of what the Maya world is. The real Maya world is involved with sacred work and all the different jobs that people have in the ceremonies together. And everything is, wow, some of my accents didn't come out right. Everything is organized by this idea, as opposed to the Western directions. We all know that there's four corners, but what I have found is that the corners define the edges of a square, and this whole side of the square will be the name of the world direction. So Chikin, this whole side is west, that whole side is south, that whole side is east. East is primary, as opposed to north in the western directional system, because this is where the sun comes up. And then Chumuk is the center. So everything has its Chumuk, and then it has four corners around it. Cornfield, townhouse, cattle corral. Am I going too long, sister?
No, Andrew is here from Ithaca, but he's lost, so
okay.
I'm kind of hoping
okay.
He finds
okay.
It.
The Chiba Maya, the family, is tremendously important. The house is tremendously important, and there's the image of the Maya woman in the door of the house ready to pour her hot boiling soup on the face of some Spaniard coming in. People still talk about the heroic nature of women willing to protect their houses. You see how rocky it is. This is all bedrock. This is all limestone, all old coral reef. And so people plant in the middle of the rocks and build their houses on top of the rocks. I'll talk in a second about how the rocks continue to protect the traditional culture. Che, laughter, is very important. This is how we create ki'imapola, happiness in our center. And when it's a group, happiness in the group center. Meyah Maya, men and women's work, interdependent, dialectic relationship between male and female to produce food in the form of corn tortillas. So men's number is four for the corn, four corners of the cornfield. Woman's number is three for the three stones, probably related to the three sisters, but Maya women will describe it as to support your comal for cooking your tortillas, you have to have three stones in a triangle, and then you can balance it, and then you can cook. So 4 + 3 = 7. 7 is the human number as a combination of the male and female principles. Tikbal Maya, chatting, the most precious gift. It's the major investment that people make in each other. And I love this picture of the women getting ready to grind their corn at the molino. Used to be that you'd have a grinding stone, but once these hand-turned metal molinos were introduced, now everybody pretty much does it that way. Sometimes they're electric. Yishim, corn. Yishimon, we are corn. If you're around Mayas a lot and they're living traditional Maya life, you know how when you eat a lot of garlic, the garlic is coming out of your body? The same way with corn. You smell like corn, okay? Mayaka, there's a lot of processions and group solidarity and group ceremonies. This was the Women's Day in the first community I lived in. This is the Sakbe. This is the Milky Way, the metaphor for the correct road that all people are supposed to try to walk on. And the elders teach these proverbs. Yankish, there are thorns. We bleed at the ankles. To be Nohan, it goes to the right. On the road of the humble. So as you walk through life, you're going to get cut if you're on the right road, and you shouldn't be afraid to bleed, and that's the way it is. My own promesa, my own sacred pledge with the elders is my own kuch, that they have given me and that I have accepted. And the main thing I'm trying to develop is a Maya truck project. This is how people take their produce to the local market. If we have one of these, we can make a 4-hour trip, go around the local market, go to the big market in Cancun, and make 10 times what people usually make. So even factoring in for gas and everything, I'm in the process of little by little trying to get $15,000 together to get the first truck. And what we've decided together is that if we get a truck, we get access to fair markets. It makes agriculture in the countryside more economically feasible, and it provides an option to continue the Maya lifestyle in the countryside. So years of discussion went into deciding to take this step. But it's very dangerous, frankly, because if we're successful, there's going to be a lot of people down there that do not want us to be successful. So we kind of have to speak quietly. So we can learn about the continuation of colonialism by seeing today's Maya reality. The traditional Maya language, culture, and leadership can be interpreted to continue because of the rocks, Chantunich. So much of the peninsula is bedrock, and you're just planting in pockets of soil with the digging stick technology. You're never going to get a tractor in there, and that kind of protects. It's the only place that, the only kind of agriculture that can be done in most of the peninsula. This is going to go for too long. In 4 decades of anthropology, I've learned of worldwide indigenous similarities. Indigenous culture teaches that the people were made from the land to care for it and each other. Ancestors taught us how, our culture, to care for the land and the people. It is our responsibility to pass those teachings to the next generation. And I think the original Maya was 9 generations, because I see in the documents Bolon's Aka, and I think that's 9 generations. So the earth equals mother, equals people, equals sacred. Women are especially sacred as life givers. It's very dramatic to see elder Maya men scold younger Maya women who are learning more Spanish cultural ways of disrespecting women and trying to make sure that that's not tolerated. Kirkpatrick Sale, who wrote The Conquest of Paradise, calls colonialism the rape of Mother Earth and Earth Mother, indigenous women. As my colleague said, as Western culture and money spread, the earth becomes transformed into real estate. A completely different worldview, a different way of perceiving the earth and people spreads with colonialism. This becomes the new norm. Anything biological, including people, is to be used for profit with no concern for long-term consequences. What Maya observations can we make, and what Maya questions can we ask about this? So just to summarize, I'll share some Maya ideas with you and some Maya questions. Translation, we are always looking for protection through ceremony. We are always joining our thoughts with our words, our hands, our work, and our hearts. And when you live that community lifestyle, this is the cycle of your day, dealing with people in this way. When I'm not in the middle of it, it feels like the better part of me is not alive. Because we are each other's selves. What is going to happen? So we're asking the same kind of questions that were in the previous presentation from a Maya point of view. The kushtats ula, lani bin tulaka tush, tuyokor kabe, is a continuation of the colonial system, the best humanity can do. With the continuing colonial characteristics being increase in industrialization, increase in deforestation, increase in climate change, increase in species extinction, greater likelihood of widespread biological death on the planet. Kind of the logical outcome of the colonialism that we're talking about so much today.
Ritsunobo, Ubeitano, Ukanko, Tukushta, Masewa. Can Westerners learn from indigenous people, their culture and experience? Can these continuing indigenous characteristics be learned about? Seeing ourselves, our families, and the earth as intertwined. It is therefore necessary to work towards deep, interdependent, open-hearted relationships with people and the earth. I was talking to my students yesterday about sincerity, the sincerity that is encouraged by the Maya language in terms of telling the truth. You know, you're sitting, you two Mayas sitting next to each other, you're waiting for a bus or something. You don't know each other. You just turn and say, Bashka Tuklik, what are you thinking? And the other one that doesn't know you says what he or she is actually thinking, because that's what you're supposed to do. And that's your starting point, dealing from truth and what I'm actually thinking about, how can we build from there? Especially in academia, it's kind of hard for me to find people that willingly do that kind of thing spontaneously. This is a daily goal in the life cycle of a Maya person living day to day. This value system is the foundation of the Itnak other self relationship. Titone emasi walogo bashuk atiyali. As for us, as for indigenous people ourselves, what will being indigenous continue to mean? Tika da humtuli, tika. What will being indigenous continue to mean on a personal scale, on a people scale, on an indigenous people scale, and on a pan-human scale? Tin wilik laili yamasiwalo beishan hebish tsuro ut tuliliko dekushta masiwalo. I have seen that there are still indigenous people and even foreigners that value and learn from indigenous culture. The old pain is healing, perhaps. We are even learning that we all come from Africa. We are truly seeing each other's selves since long ago. We are truly each other's selves since long ago. Again, as I've mentioned before, the reconstruction of different lines of mitochondrial DNA or Y chromosome tell the same story. So perhaps colonial competition and getting ahead of each other's expense is slowly giving way to we're all in this together. Perhaps we reach our potential as a species when this happens, when colonial destruction is reversed, and we stop wasting human and earth potential. This is my fantasy, shaped by both anthropology as an expression of Westerners valuing non-Westerners, and the similarity between the world's indigenous cultures. The combination is possible because it has already happened. At present, there is still great danger in the world. Perhaps we need the healing to happen more quickly. But will this healing continue? As we say in Maya, only you will say for sure. Thank you very much.
Great. We'll have another little tiny short break. One of our speakers, Scott Sisson, is not coming, Mike Carpentier. After the break, I will give my paper, and then we will hear from Andrew Kirby, who is Navajo, and he is just starting here. So please help yourself to...